The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested indirectly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Salnier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor.
This is the Retirement and IRA Show coming to you from beautiful Northern Colorado. Join us as certified financial planner Jim Salnier, as well as Colorado State University finance instructor and certified financial planner Chris Stein, teach you about IRAs, 401ks, annuities, Social Security, pension plans, and estate planning in a fun and enjoyable show. Whether you are listening live in Colorado or streaming from their website or iTunes podcast, Jim and Chris want you to know that they're available to help you plan for your retirement. Just visit their website at jimhelps.com. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. And click the Meet the Team button on the homepage. Now, here's Jim and Chris with today's show.
Well, welcome to the Retirement and IRA Show Q&A edition for this week. Thanks a lot for joining us. Lately, I've been liking to remind people how to, again, get questions to us in case they don't listen all the way to the end of the show. That would be to either email Jim. His email address is jim@jimhelps.com, or you can go to our website, jimhelps.com. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. On there, there's a contact form. You can submit questions that way as well. So I've got Jim joining me from his home studio today, and he's got a pile of questions ready. And as always, I'm pretty sure we're going to start with a Social Security question, unless he's got something more exciting to talk about first. We'll see what he says.
Well, what I say is, yes, we have something. Well, actually, no, we don't have anything more exciting than a Social Security question to lead with. I wish I did. There's nothing exciting going on in my life. Damn.
Oh, well, that's okay.
Anything exciting going on in your life?
I had a flat tire this morning.
Oh, that sucks. How'd that happen?
Yeah. Believe it or not, it was the car wash contributed to the issue. So it turns out I have a cracked valve stem on the car, on my truck, actually. And I can't imagine it's a coincidence that I just went through a car wash with those spinning fabric octopus-looking cleaner things on there. And
right,
now,
yeah.
In their defense, I'm sure it's the original valve stems from 2005 and, you know, 17 years of sun and weather. I'm sure the rubber was not as pliable as it originally was. So not the end of the world. At least I don't have a hole in my tire. It's just the valve stem needs to be replaced. So if we can count that as something exciting, yes, I have that excitement in my life.
Well, I'm just curious because I'm not in the office, folks. I'm working from home today. Did it go flat right in the car wash?
No. It wasn't until this morning.
Oh,
so
okay.
So I came out this morning to come to work, and it was flat. And I pumped it up enough to then listen for the hissing sound, and I was actually pleased to find out there wasn't a big gaping hole in my tire itself. It was just the valve stem. So I'm getting it fixed tomorrow morning. No problem.
You're just going to take the tire off, take it in, and get it fixed?
Actually, I'm due for a rotate and balance anyway, so I'm just going to take it in and get it all done at the same time.
Oh, so obviously you can fill it with air and drive to the tire place?
Yes.
Oh, so it doesn't go flat that fast. All right,
correct.
No problem. Gotcha. Well, yeah, I wouldn't put that in the category of exciting. So we probably already lost half our new listeners. Like, who are these guys? What is that those car guys? I think they both passed away, but they were from Boston. This is not that car show, whatever
clack,
the hell the name
Tappet
of it
Brothers.
Is.
Yeah, they're no, that was a great show. I used to listen to that all the time.
Yeah, I think
I
they
can
both
only
died,
imagine.
Right?
I don't know. The show's not on anymore that I know of.
No, the show's not on.
But
yeah.
That was a fabulous show. I love that show.
Yeah, well,
hope
this is
hope
not it.
Still
so
around.
If anyone's wondering why we're talking about flat tires, it's because we wanted something exciting. This is actually a Q&A show for retirement planning folks. We've got Q. We have the Qs and you. No. You have the A's. Oh, Jesus. The people listening have the questions. We have the answers. Oh, man, we are muffing this up big time today. So anyways, we're gonna do that. But before I get into it, I do have to ask our listeners, mm-hmm. our longtime listeners, not mm-hmm. the ones who probably have deleted the podcast and given us a one-star rating already, but the ones who actually listen. I'm serious. I've got a question out there, and I know our listeners can come through with this. You know I like to garden, right, Chris? Mm-hmm.
Yes.
This year, because I made some squash soup with all my own ingredients, except obviously for the ground pork, because I don't raise pigs, but except for, it's an onion-looking thing that begins with an S. It's not scallion. It's a...
Shallots.
Shallots. Thank you. Okay, mm-hmm. listeners. I am trying to grow shallots this year, so I actually ordered shallots. They don't come in a seed like an onion does.
No,
Anyways, I'm getting
bulb.
I'm getting 10 shallot starts, they called them, and it said they can make up to 50 shallots. I have no idea how that works. If you all are out there and grow shallots, would someone mind sending me a couple of tips? I've never grown them in my life. I'm going to try to grow shallots. I've ordered them. I guess I could Google them, but I thought I would ask because
I was going to say there's this wonderful new invention called Google.
Yeah, called Google. Yeah, but there might be a listener who has tips. So okay. If you've grown those onion looking things that begin with an S called shallots, let me know. All right.
Is there anything else? You need some cleaning tips or anything else while we're on the show?
Well, maybe. I could use some cleaning tips. I'm going to need some dating tips eventually. Hopefully this is going well, but I'll cue you in on all that later. But never, as a tip, Chris, try to buy a woman clothes. I'll just leave it at that. Because apparently you don't know their sizes. And
hello? Why would you even attempt that?
I was trying to be nice.
Oh, man. Okay, we'll talk
later. But apparently...
Later. We'll talk later about that.
Yeah, I'm learning. Idea. You do not buy women clothes.
No.
Especially clothes that their rear end has to fit in. You do not do that.
Wow. How old are you?
57, and I'm just learning this.
Well, that explains something.
Why I'm single since 57?
Yes. Just saying.
I was being nice.
Clearly. I'm sure that took the edge off.
Anyways, let's move on to a Social Security question. How's that?
Sure.
All right. Where is the Social Security question? There it is. All right. This one is kind of newish. I think we would have answered part two of his question before, but it's interesting. So we will begin. He used to be in Germany, so I can't say it's from someone in Germany, but he is from, as he puts it, the humid state of Florida, where I will be with this woman who I tried to be nice and buy clothes for in July. So I
well,
think
maybe.
I will. I think we'll be okay. I'll cue you in later what happened. Maybe okay. I'll tell the listener. There'll be only Jim could do that.
A lot of thin ice between now and July.
Oh, there is. But don't buy clothes. Just buy a hat. They can't screw up a hat or gloves.
I don't know. Gloves. Yeah. Gloves are okay.
Just don't buy anything that their rear end is going to fit in, and I think you'll be okay. Yeah. All right. So he's from the humid state of Florida, where I will be in July. He begins, "Hi, Jim and Chris. Love the show, especially the Q&A. Hopefully he's still a listener. I have a Social Security question. I worked in Germany for a German company from 1981 to 1987. On my Social Security statements, I have 7 years of zero for earned income. Doing some research online, I learned about the totalization agreement, nailed that one, totalization agreement between the U.S. and Germany. If I'm understanding correctly, the United States Social Security Administration will recognize income earned in Germany when calculating my Social Security benefit. So I called the Social Security office and asked how to get this German wage information sent over to the Social Security Administration so I can get a better estimate of what my Social Security benefit will be. They informed me that the Social Security Administration office will do this automatically when I claim Social Security. So I'm wondering, can it really be this seamless? Is there something more I should be doing now to make sure that this actually happens? I have my Germany guest worker card and number, but it does not indicate any wages. That's his first question, Chris. Mm-hmm. Second question, I was furloughed for half of 2020, and I'm back to work at half my pre-COVID compensation. I should announce, listeners, he wrote this email November of last year, 2021. So I'll be back to work at half of my pre-COVID compensation. When I received my Social Security statement this year, my benefits had dropped $60. This may happen again since my compensation is lower for 2021 and will be lower for 2022. I plan to retire at the end of 2022 when I'm 64. I have 30 years of earnings history, including those 7 years that they marked as zero. Love the show and appreciate the help you and Chris provide. Thank you in advance from the hot, sticky, humid state of Florida. So he's just kind of wondering what's going to happen with his lower earnings as well.
Yeah. So a couple things. There is essentially, I don't know if they're really treaties, but agreements between many countries in the United States to address this exact problem that he's describing, where someone works in two different countries and sometimes multiple countries. And he is correct that Germany is one of the countries where they have what's called a totalization agreement to help equalize and reduce the penalty someone might experience by having two, and also makes up so that you don't really end up with a windfall as well. It's kind of an equalization almost, kind of an attempt that they make. And they've got a bunch of formulas that are confusing, honestly, to dig through. There is, if you just Google or search for Social Security totalization agreements, you'll get some documentation directly from Social Security on this. And a lot of countries, a lot of European countries in particular, that are part of this. But even some Asian countries, Japan is one of them. South Korea is another one. Uruguay, even, you know, so South America. So there's countries all over the place that have entered into these agreements with the United States, and they essentially agree to credit each other's systems in some format in the background. I don't know exactly what cash flows happen, but that's not really important for this. The important thing is he should get some type of benefits or recognition for that German work back in the 80s that he described. And his question as far as can it be this seamless, will it just automatically happen? It might. It might actually work this way. I've actually heard of people it just working exactly like they described, where they went in and when they claimed, they already had record attached to him somehow in the background it had attached to his Social Security number already. They then go to these formulas that they use, which are not used to generate that benefit statement he's getting. So the benefit statement isn't sophisticated enough to include this kind of a variable in there. So it's got to be, it's a manual operation on their end, is my understanding. So this will be done, and then he'll be notified what the adjustment is. So it is probably true. He can't really find out until he claims, but he's really close here at the end of 2022. So he's less than a year away from claiming. And I suspect he'll go in and find that it just kind of works. There might be a delay in them telling him what his ultimate benefit's going to be. They're not going to usually do the calculation right there in front of him, the way I understand it. I think they do it, and then they let him know what the benefit adjustment is. But that should handle it. Now, there are lots of things less complicated than this that the Social Security Administration doesn't always handle very smoothly, or things kind of fall through the cracks. So I would expect this would be something more often than other issues that comes up and falls through the cracks. So I would be thinking about it. I wouldn't put forth a lot of effort, because if it does work easily, then, you know, any effort you go through to investigate what your earnings were back in the 1980s, it's going to be wasted time and effort for everybody involved. So I'd wait until it doesn't happen, but mentally prepare yourself not to panic. That if it takes some time for this to get all worked out, you might have to do a little research, supply a little additional information. Not a lot of people have documentation from 35 years ago, but to the extent you have something, make sure you hang on to it. Once they figure it out, then they'll make any adjustments. So Social Security is actually really good that if they start paying you the wrong benefit and then it gets fixed at some point later, they'll make good on it all the way back to when they should have been paying you. They're actually quite good at doing that when there's a mistake or some new additional information comes in that adjusts your benefit in some way and they need to fix it retroactively. They handle that. And so I wouldn't worry too much about being out money in the long run, but if it doesn't work smoothly, you might have to do a little bit more, you know, digging or supply a little bit more information. The second part of his question I did want to comment on because it is a little different scenario. Here he's talking about he's right close to retirement. It wasn't until the end of his question that he divulged his age, but he's going to be 64 this year in 2022, and then he's planning to claim at that time. A reduced benefit, I'll point out, because his full retirement age is going to be 66 and 8 months, being born in 1958. So he'll take a reduction for claiming it at that time. He probably knows that if he's looked into it at all, or listened to the podcast regularly. We talk about that all the time. But this $60 change from just having a half work reduction in 1 year seems kind of drastic. Most people aren't going to experience that. They're not going to experience that because they've got a nice, robust, full 35 years of earnings history that's being used in the calculation. So 1 year at the end that is real big or real small doesn't usually have a giant effect, a real noticeable effect on your Social Security benefit. But he's got these 8 years or 7 years of zeros in there. And he made a comment, I have 30 years of earnings history recorded, including the 7 years from Germany. Well, right now, they're not counting those seven in his benefit statement estimate. So he's really only dealing with 23 out of 35 years, because they're still using 35 years to create this average that determines his Social Security benefit. So when one of those 23 years is suddenly different, it's having a greater impact on him than it would on other people that have a full 35-year history that they're dealing with. So I just wanted to point that out because people probably heard that and thought, oh my gosh, if I work half-time, suddenly I'm going to see a big, you know, noticeable drop in my lifetime Social Security benefit. In reality, he probably isn't going to see that effect from his COVID furlough because once they incorporate those 7 years of missing earnings from Germany, that's going to change the math, if you will. And it also, you have to recall that when you have a lower earnings year, all of a sudden your benefit statement is going to use that last year as their assumption moving forward for how much you're going to make until you claim Social Security. So it doesn't just affect that 1 year, it actually affects their forward-looking estimate, which for people in their 60s usually is no big deal because the forward-looking part was just a couple of years. But the younger you are, if you have one of these disruptions in your earnings, for instance, you maybe leave work for a couple years, what they do is they actually look at last year's earnings and assume you're going to earn that until you claim Social Security. So if you're 45 and you take a year off or something, you're going to have a zero. Now, if you have a zero, they look back one additional year. Assuming you had the year off, they don't want to put a zero in there for the assumption moving forward some 20 years. But if you've got 2 years in a row, say you take time off to raise a child or something like that, suddenly your Social Security benefit estimate is way off the younger you are. So keep that in mind, their base assumption that you're going to make the same as you did last year, or if you had no earnings last year, make the same as 2 years ago until you claim Social Security. And if you're in your 40s, this might be 20 plus years in the future. They're plugging into the formula, you know, 20 years of zeros, essentially, in their benefit estimate. So take those benefit estimates with a grain of salt. It's usually a lot better to use a calculator that will allow you to put in your own estimates for when you're going to stop work, when you're going to claim, you know, what your earnings history moving forward is likely to look like, instead of using these plain vanilla assumptions that Social Security is using in that benefit statement. Because in certain cases, like I just pointed out, it can drastically distort what your Social Security benefit estimate is. So I wanted to point that out as well.
Perfect. Cool. And you officially longer than me.
What do you mean?
You answer questions very long and detailed. Just
you gave
like
me like a multi-part question with international ramifications.
You pick on me when I go on and on. But I think that's what makes our show sweet. People realize, hey, they're actually going to try to answer and go deep. No, I think it's great. And I think our listeners do, too. Or they wouldn't be listening, I suppose. The next question, which is the new question of the week, is a little special thing, folks. It's already been recorded. So Chris is actually going to dub it in at this point in the recordings that you'll hear. Chris and Bob answered it yesterday. It was a Social Security question, but I thought it was really,
it's
good.
Really a tax
because
question,
this,
yeah.
Yeah, it was a tax-related question that she picked up on something this year that she didn't have to deal with last year as it relates to Social Security and taxation. So that's going to play next.
Okay, Bob, thanks a lot for joining us. I know you're busy with tax prep season, but we got an interesting tax-related question in, and so thanks for agreeing to come in and handle this for us.
You're welcome, Chris. Glad to be here.
Yeah, nice to see you. We don't see a whole lot of you at times during tax prep season, so nice to see your face.
Neither does the sun.
Yeah, exactly. So yeah, we got this question in. Let's just dive right into it. It's pretty. Okay. It's interesting. I think it's not something I've heard talked about prior. So here's the email. Dear Jim, Chris, and maybe Bob. I'm going to say definitely Bob. As a do-it-yourselfer, I love your podcast. I sat down to do my 2021 income taxes, and I think I found a change in the formula used for calculating taxable Social Security benefits. Last year, tax year 2020, the IRS worksheet for calculating how much Social Security was subject to federal income tax allowed the $300 deduction for charitable contributions for taxpayers electing the standard deduction to be subtracted from the income subject to Social Security taxation. This year, 2021 tax year, I noticed that this $300 line item deduction was omitted from the small print of the directions for the Social Security benefits worksheet. What gives? There's no notification or of change anywhere, even though this change results in up to $255 more of Social Security benefits being taxed. I cannot find anywhere in Schedule 1, Adjustments to Income, where that last year's deduction can be recouped or recovered. Goes on to say, am I missing something or has Uncle Sam pulled a fast one? The $300 deduction is still allowed from total income, just not from income subject to Social Security. But obviously that deduction is only worth $45 if your AGI was increased by $255 before you can subtract it. Unfortunately, Ohio does not count Social Security and state AGI, which is used to calculate real estate tax, so that's not really related to this part. So they sent along a couple screenshots. So what gives on this change to the worksheet here?
Well, I'm going to just step back for a moment, talk about this $300, now potentially $600 kind of bonus deduction for those that contribute to charity but are no longer itemizing their deduction Schedule A, where we itemize or we take the standard deduction. And of course, we usually default to the one that's the higher number. And so what Congress did is part of the CARES Act in 2020, they said, if you're taking a standard deduction, because we know a lot of people are now because we've increased those limits, right, and you're doing charity, you know, we'll allow you to take a $300 per tax return deduction maximum deduction, which was calculated as a deduction to arrive to AGI. And that's what's key. It was above the line or above the AGI calculation on your tax return. And so what happened is this year they extended the deduction and they actually made it up to $600 if you're a joint filer, so $300 single, $600 married filing jointly, but they moved it to below the line. So now it's a deduction from AGI.
Right.
That ordering is what's impacted her Social Security calculation. It's not that the Social Security calculation changed, her AGI changed, or the computation from this special $300 or $600 deduction, and how it's either towards AGI or from AGI that impacted the taxability of her Social Security, as it did not lower her AGI this year like it did.
Yeah. So in the grand scheme of things, the deduction still is granted. They're using the standard deduction, but they're taking advantage of this carve out that Congress allowed for those who are taking the standard deduction, but then get up to this, as you mentioned, $600 for a married filing joint couple of charitable deduction. So the deduction still is valid, but it changes how much of the Social Security gets sucked into this taxable status for certain people. I'm trying to think of a way to benefit from this. Is there, she's just in the unfortunate crowd that's harmed, and other people get a benefit from this? Or what do you think? Is this possible to be good news for anybody?
I'm not sure how it could be good news for anyone. You know, everyone gets the benefit of less taxable income. So either $300 or $600 of your income is not going to be taxed if you're eligible for the deduction. So that's still good. But because the opportunity to decrease your AGI by a charitable, you know, bonus, call it a bonus charitable deduction, the loss of the ability to lower your AGI is what's impacting her, in the sense that she happens to be in that range where her Social Security is not tax-free, and it's also not being taxed at the full 85%. So she's in that range somewhere, and that range is directly driven off of your AGI. And by losing the benefit to lower that AGI, it's causing the calculation of her taxability of Social Security to go up by the $255. So in that case, almost a wash for her. For other folks, you know, on either end of the extreme of taxability, Social Security is not going to really make a difference. Still going to save you a few income tax dollars. I think the other big case to look out for is Irma. We know that's a basis of your AGI modified by a couple numbers that were, again, in the prior year, the ability to get that AGI, that MAGI down just a hair below a cliff might have happened.
Right.
Opportunity not there this year.
Right. And since the Irma triggers are that cliff, like you mentioned, it's people that are right at the edge of that cliff, this $300 or $600 shift could push them over the edge into the next Irma tier. So, yeah, that's definitely bad news for people close to that edge, if you will. So,
you know, and if that, you know, if somebody was planning it that close, and that $300 or $600, deduction was part of their planning, you know, that's going to be a detriment in a couple years when they see what their Medicare costs are going to be.
Right. Right. Okay. Well, great. I'm glad you clarified that, because I hadn't really run across this or heard. I agree with them. I hadn't heard any announcement about this change. You didn't hear anything ahead of time, right? It just kind of came out.
You know, I'll be honest with you. I noticed it when I started looking at the new tax forms this year.
At the form.
And yeah. I always look at, you know, I do like a comparison report, and I started seeing it. Well, I saw where it moved in the reports. I knew it had changed. I can't find, you know, any good reasoning anywhere out there as to why they changed that in the forms or the structure of the tax return. But certainly some folks are picking it up as it's, you know, occasionally landing in the right or wrong area and kind of making an impact.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, great. Yeah. Well, thanks for taking a little time for us here in your tax prep. We'll wish you good luck. Hopefully you see the sun every now and then. And if we don't squeeze one in again before tax season's over, we'll look forward to talking to you again after tax season.
Sounds good. Thank you, Chris.
Sure. Thanks, Bob. See ya. Yep.
Okay, perfect. So hopefully everybody liked that question. I thought it was good, and that's why I made it the new question of the week. Remember, folks, because right now we are wrapping up October's questions, And starting November's questions, the first Social Security question was from November. I thought we would be nice and try to give people who send newer questions an opportunity to get their question answered sooner rather than later, because we're several months behind. That's why we have the new question of the week, and I thought that was a good one. Okay, this one is, wow, this one's actually from May of last year, so he's been waiting a while.
What happened to that one? It ended up in the October pile?
It just, I don't know. I try my hardest to print these and keep them orderly, but people just mess up my papers when I'm not there looking. And then when I come back, they're just all out of order. So anyways, it's a good one. A pretty good one. I thought we would answer it, but it's from May. Hopefully he didn't mind waiting this long. He gives his real name. We're going to call him George, as we always do. He's from the fine state of, want to take a guess? Begins with an N.
Nebraska.
The first word is new.
York.
Jersey. Close. We narrowed it down and you are still wrong. Alrighty. Begins, hi Jim and Chris. I'm 63 and I opened up a Roth IRA in 2017. I have funded it every year using the backdoor Roth approach. Mm-hmm. I also have a 401k with $2 million in it. For the record, he has $26,500 in his Roth. He has $2 million in his 401k. In 2020, I converted $185,000 from my 401k directly into the same Roth account that I have. Mm-hmm. But now I'm wondering, would my ERISA protections be quote-unquote stronger if I had used a separate Roth IRA rather than using the single account that I have been doing my backdoor Roths into? Mm-hmm. Am I jeopardizing my ERISA creditor and bankruptcy protection by merging these accounts? Does it even matter? He then goes on to say, I am retired and not planning to have any future earned income. An opportunity may come up, so I'm delaying converting my 401k to a traditional IRA so that I will still have the option to do the back door in future years if I decide to go back to work. That way I won't run into the pro rata rule. But I do imagine at some point in the future, I will most likely convert my 401k to a traditional IRA. That's all for now. Thank you. He gives his name. He's got a few things in there that you probably picked up on like I did that I want to make sure he gets a better understanding of. Let's look at his first question, Chris. Would my ERISA... And for those who don't know, folks, ERISA is the Employee Retirement Income Security Act. Came out in the 1970s. It's the very act that created IRAs, for those who didn't know. And it gave special protections to pension plans and employer-sponsored retirement plans, of which 401ks are one, even though 401ks didn't exist back then. But it gives them special protections from creditors, or as Pete, when he used to be on this show, called predators, and bankruptcy. So you get special protections on those accounts. And if you're a spouse, you get special protections to keep the working spouse who created the account from disinheriting you. It's almost impossible to disinherit a spouse from an ERISA-protected plan without that spouse specifically giving up their rights to it. So there are a lot of protections, I think you would agree, Chris, under the ERISA law.
Yes.
Okay.
And they're nice because they're consistent state to state because they're at the federal level.
They're at the federal level. But a couple of things. He said, would my ERISA protections be, quote unquote, stronger if I used a separate Roth? And then he says, I don't want to jeopardize my ERISA creditor and bankruptcy protection by merging the two accounts. By merging, he means, should he have kept the $185,000 he converted separate from the $26,500 he contributed? The answer to that is no. But I do want to make sure he understands a few things. The only ERISA protection that moves from the 401k to your IRA, Chris, is what?
I'm sorry, what did you say? I was reading something else, sorry.
You're almost ready to answer
I was looking up New
correct.
Jersey, yeah.
You're almost ready to answer correct. The only ERISA protections, because he says he doesn't want to jeopardize his creditor protection, or what Pete used to call predator protection, or his bankruptcy protection. And he's wondering if he jeopardized that by mixing the two Roth accounts. I asked you, what is the only ERISA protection that transfers over to your IRA? The bankruptcy protection. He asked if mixing those together would somehow jeopardize it. The short answer is no, but it makes it harder to track. If you truly are concerned, you're going to declare bankruptcy, and with 2+ million of retirement assets and who knows how many non-retirement assets or illiquid assets or real estate or whatever this gentleman may own, bankruptcy hopefully will never happen to him, because that means he's lost all his money somewhere. But if you truly do worry about bankruptcy protection and you want to easily be able to prove to a bankruptcy court, this money in my Roth account came from the 401k and is therefore fully protected up to any dollar amount, keep them separate. But mixing $185,000 with $26,000, I don't think you're going to run into that issue. But you could keep them separate, and it's only for an accounting reason. It doesn't give you any greater protection. Right. Remember, contributions are only protected up to – did you Google that and see what are contributions protected? I think it's $1.3 million.
It changes all the time. It's about $1.3 right. million, yeah.
Okay. You only got $26,000 of contributions, listener. And all totaled, you have less than $200,000. So under any measure, the $1.3 million of contributions plus growth on those contributions that's protected, and the unlimited protection from a 401k being transferred into an IRA, you don't have to worry about bankruptcy. That Roth at the federal level will be protected from bankruptcy. But what I want everyone to understand, there's two types of creditors here, and I hope he understands that. There is a bankruptcy creditor, or what we just call bankruptcy, but right. they're really creditors going after you. And there's the predator creditor that Pete always references. That's why he calls those creditors predators, to kind of separate them from bankruptcy. So he would say bankruptcy and predators. A predator creditor is someone going after you because you caused an auto accident, and you just took out a bus full of attorneys, you had someone come to your property and they trip and fell, you're being held responsible for something. You are being sued personally because you caused someone pain or libel or something. That type of creditor protection does not, quote unquote, transfer over from your 401k. If it's in your 401k because of ERISA, it's fully protected. But if you think you're going to be sued by a predator creditor, you have to look where, Chris?
State law.
Exactly. Each state will protect IRAs differently. And as Chris pointed out, I think on last week's show, if not last week, the week before, Roth IRAs sometimes get different predator creditor protection than a traditional IRA. So you really need to either research New Jersey state law or counsel with a attorney in the state of New Jersey, preferably an attorney well-schooled in creditor protection, not just a general attorney who may not know all the rules, if you want to find out how much predator creditor protection that Roth IRA will have. Think I missed anything on that part of his question, Chris?
No. And in the meantime, what I was reading, I was just double checking. And it is best to obviously consult your own lawyer. But according to several reputable legal sources, New Jersey has good creditor protection for IRAs, both traditional and Roth style.
Predator creditor, you're talking?
Yes.
Perfect. So yeah. That's good news, listener. But as Chris said, you might want to consult with your attorney. But separating them out isn't necessary unless you're truly worried someday of being sued and you really want to identify those 401k assets. But there's no need to separate them except for mental accounting purposes. Okay. So then he continues, Chris, am I jeopardizing my ERISA creditor protection, yada, 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 by merging the funds? Does it matter? I answered that. In my opinion, no, it doesn't matter. I am retired but not planning to have any future earned income. He doesn't want to move the rest of his IRA, his 401k, Chris, to an IRA because he wants to keep doing the back door and not fall victim, if you will, to the pro rata rule. Mm-hmm. Why don't you quickly explain to new listeners who have no clue what all that means, why that at face value is a good decision if he thinks someday he might go back to work and might have earned income and might want to do the back door, why that would blow up if he moved what is the remaining $1.8 million into an IRA.
If you move it into the IRA or IRA, I don't usually call them IRAs, but that's okay. A lot of people do, like Jim. And you'll now have a lot of pre-tax, non-deducted money that was, deducted money that was placed into the 401k originally, now transferred over, rolled over into the IRA. When you're trying to do a Roth conversion, which is part of the backdoor contribution technique, that is under attack. It hasn't disappeared yet, but is under threat. There's the pro rata rule that has to be considered. But what that means is that as money comes out of that traditional IRA, by IRS rule, it must come out pro rata between the pre and post tax dollars that exist in there. And so if you contaminate your IRA with this pre-tax 401k rolled in money, you now are going to subject to future distributions, rollovers, which is part of the conversion process, to that pro rata rule. And it won't work nearly as cleanly as if you have an empty traditional IRA, which is the best tool to use for the backdoor technique. So I didn't go through all the nuances of the backdoor, but that's the ramifications of the pro rata rule and why he rightfully is keeping the IRA clean, not rolling in that money until he's sure that's over. Now, once they, appears likely, pull the rug out from under doing backdoor Roth contributions, which involve this conversion process, then he won't have to worry about it anymore, and could then likely put it into the IRA if that's what he wants to do. There's lots of reasons to keep it in the 401k versus rolling it. So I'm not saying he absolutely should, but this reason would go away if he's not able to do backdoor Roths anymore.
Perfect. That's 100% correct. Everything. I just want to mention one quick thing for a new listener who might be saying, well, Chris, what if he didn't move that money into his $1.8 million IRA and just opened up a separate IRA and kept them apart? Mm-hmm. That doesn't work, no. Listeners, because the IRS considers all your IRAs one big one. So I was just wondering when you explained it, if someone would be thinking that.
Yeah, good point.
Okay, the one thing I want to point out to him with this, you say you might go back to work, you don't know. Look, if you are unsure about moving it, don't move. As Chris said, there's a lot of reasons to move a 401k, there's a lot of reasons not to move a 401k, as the very next question we're going to answer gets into. But the earnings limits of how much you can earn before you would have to do the back door are quite high, as he probably knows. If he was doing the back door in the past, he obviously was making more. He doesn't tell me if he's married or single, but the amount you can earn is quite high. It's six figures. If you're going to go back to work at a part-time basis or consultative basis and make substantially less than the earnings limit, you don't need to worry about having to get money into a Roth via the back door at that point. So do keep that in mind. Just going back to work doesn't mean you have to do the back door. It's going back to work and earning more than those earnings limits for making contributions to Roths that you would have to do the back door strategy of putting money into a traditional IRA and immediately converting it into a Roth. Okay. The only other thing I want to straighten out for him, he keeps saying when he moves his 401k to his traditional IRA, he words it several times as a conversion. Right. That is not a conversion, listener and listeners. A conversion is when you change the tax treatment of that tax-qualified account.
Yeah.
When you go from an always taxable IRA to a never taxable Roth, that is a conversion. When you move from a 401k to an IRA, it is always considered a rollover, even though you might be, quote unquote, transferring the money directly. It's called a direct rollover. Whenever a 401k and an IRA are involved, it's a rollover. You are merely rolling over your money from a 401k to an IRA. It's not a conversion because it's maintaining the same always taxable treatments of the money when it's removed. So I just wanted to clarify that as well.
Perfect.
Perfect. All righty. The next one, as I kind of hinted at, has to do with should I move or should I not move? Oh, that we too bad we didn't have the sound effect of that song. Should I stay or should I go?
Yeah.
Yeah. That would be a good one. Who sings that? Oh, The Clash, right? The Clash. That's a blast to the past of the 1980s.
Wow. Yeah.
Yeah. So I bet you didn't think I could pull that out.
Yeah, I wasn't quite sure. what exact year, though?
Oh, gosh, I have no idea, but it's definitely the 80s. Should I stay or should I go now is definitely the 80s, but I have no idea when.
Yeah, did you definitely Google The Clash. It is from 1981. Written in 81. We'll see when it actually came out. Sometimes they're written beforehand. Released 82, May 82. Of 1982.
Yeah. I just remember going clubbing back then. I was in my early 20s, obviously, and that song was just a big hit.
Yep.
All righty. Anyways, so this is a pretty good question. It's got a lot of moving parts to it. I thought people would find it good. It's from September of last year. So just kind of wrapping up that September-October period as we bleed a little into November of last year. Okay. It says, greetings, Jim and Chris. Thank you for your informative podcast. I've become a regular listener and appreciate the information you share. I retired at age 63. He kind of gets into a lot of what he has, but in short, he says he has no Roth IRA at all due to compensation limitations while he was working. Mm-hmm. He could have done the back door back then. He didn't. So he has no Roth, Chris. Mm-hmm. He's 63. He retired in 2021. No Roth. I have $1.8 million in my 401k, and $130,000 of it is after-tax contributions. Mm. He said, I wanted to start rolling funds annually from my 401k beginning in 2022 and do this through 2026 into an IRA and then into a Roth while managing the amounts to keep within the 24% federal tax bracket each year. Let me pause there. You no longer have to do a what they used to call a conduit IRA.
Right.
Years ago, it's not too far back, I think 8 years ago, maybe 10, mm-hmm. 6, somewhere around there, you had to move a 401k to an IRA first and then convert it to a Roth. And they called those conduit IRAs because mm-hmm. just like a conduit pipe, the money flew in and flew right back out into the Roth. The IRS eventually realized and Congress eventually realized that's stupid.
Yeah.
So they removed that and you can just convert directly in. So no problem, listener. You don't have to go to an IRA first to get the 401k money into a Roth. Okay. I understand that distributions from my 401k into my IRA will be split between pre- and post-tax dollars, and they will split it on a pro rata basis, thereby allowing me to contribute my post-tax dollars to a Roth, and I will need to pay taxes on any other Roth conversions I do. So he's correct mm-hmm. there, listeners, as well. When you move money from a 401k that has pre- and post-tax dollars in it, when the money comes out of the 401k, just picture this, folks, a 401k, and all of a sudden money like a bubble just blooping out of the 401k and standing there. That big bubble that contains money will be split into a small bubble and a bigger bubble. The custodian, the 401k custodian, does this. It gets split. It always comes out of the 401k pro rata. You cannot just choose your post-tax, excuse me, yeah, your post-tax $138,000 that he has in there, Chris, as you know. It always comes out pro rata, one big bubble, and then the custodian will break that bubble pro rata between what is after-tax contributions and what is pre-tax contributions and growth. and the bubbles will float, if you will. The pre-tax contributions and all growth will go into the IRA. The post-tax dollars, the tax-free dollars, I've already paid taxes on them, will float right into a Roth, neither one being taxable, because the only money going into the Roth is contributions that he already paid taxes on, mm-hmm. after-tax contributions. And he rightly pointed out, if he also converts into that Roth additional money, that money would be taxable. In other words, if he didn't want to move just that small little post-tax bubble, but he wanted to move some of that larger pre-tax bubble into the Roth, he could without going through a conduit, and that would be taxable. Do you think people can visualize what I just mm-hmm. described okay?
Yeah, I think so. One thing I'll add, though, I thought we ran across some 401k administrators and plans that would actually allow you to distribute the after-tax part separately.
If the 401k tracks it and
right, allows
goes to
it
a couple and, of and other a, loops,
and accounts for it separately. So I just wanted to make that point because you said it's always going to come out pro rata. His plan sounds like it does that way, but it is possible your plan would allow more flexibility where you could just move the 130 directly to the Roth IRA, and that would be super clean and super nice.
Correct. But any plan that doesn't have that capability always comes out pro rata. That's
exactly
what I meant.
Yep.
That's what I meant. Thank you for picking up on that.
Sure.
Okay. Here's where he gets a little interesting. He says, my reason for continuing to keep my 401k are due to the investment options it contains, the low fees of the account, solid performance so far, 401k legal protections, mm-hmm. and in particular, a very solid fixed income fund that I have been using to balance out stock market risk. He lists a lot of good reasons for keeping a 401k. Mm-hmm. So I kind of want to pause and talk a little bit to our listeners about this. Be very wary of any advisor. And I'm not throwing advisors under the bus. Chris and I are an advisory firm that just instantly, automatically wants to move your money. You'll often find that with AUM advisors. Obviously, they get paid if they're managing money. So they always encourage people to move money. The government has been going after this for years. So have 401k custodians. Both have different motives. 401k custodians don't like the bleeding that happens from 401ks when people retire. They want to try to keep most 401k custodians, I should add, very small employers or relatively small employers with relatively small plans don't want to deal with the administrative headaches and actually make it all but unfavorable to keep the money in the 401k. They limit the amount of times you can withdraw. Some charge, we've seen this, Chris, they charge mm-hmm. for every withdrawal you want to make, including RMDs. They limit you to one withdrawal a quarter. They just make it really difficult and ridiculous to keep. Those accounts, they just want out. They don't want to deal with the headaches. But a lot of larger 401ks, the more money in them, ostensibly, the lower the fees everybody in the 401k could pay. Now, the cynic in me would say the more the 401k administrator is making. And it's true. They make more the more money that's in the 401k. But the 401k participants do benefit as well because the more people in it, the lower their costs. The government wants to slow it down for a different reason. And this started under the Obama administration with their Department of Labor that really took a hard look at this and came out with a study. I don't know how accurate their study was, and I don't know the exact dollar amount. Chris can Google it, but they came out with a study that claimed moving money out of a 401k was costing American retirees, I think they said, $2 or $3 billion a year. Did you find that study?
No, I don't find I'm not finding the exact one that you're talking about.
Okay.
It was a lot of money, though.
It was a lot of money. Yeah. The thing I didn't like about the study, I didn't see the math behind it. I'm not disputing it. I just would have liked to have seen how they came up with that projection. Mm-hmm. So because of that, they really tried to crack down and make the advisors who were encouraging people to leave the 401k, make them truly disclose fully the additional fees. They blamed the loss, the bleed, if you will, solely on fees.
Right.
They were saying, look, this is hurting American retirees. They're leaving a low cost and going to a high cost account and are not being told the additional fees they are going to be paid. So the Department of Labor under the Obama administration came out and said, we're going to regulate this. And they tried to pass a law called the DOL rule, for lack of a better term, Department of Labor. The Department of Labor, folks, regulates 401ks, not the IRS. Surprise, surprise. We need that sound effect as well from Goma Pyle.
I don't have that one.
You don't have that. We used to. Everybody thinks the IRS regulates 401ks. It's Department of Labor, folks. Department of Labor regulates 401ks. They were concerned about the bleed and the very high billions that they were claiming American retirees were losing every year were solely on the fees that quote-unquote advisors were going to earn on this money. So they came out with a whole series of rules and laws, and it just it went on throughout most of the Obama administration. It never truly became, it came close to being law, and then it was pulled back by the courts. The industry was fighting it for a variety of reasons. Some in the industry were very positive for it. Others in the industry were very negative against it. Under the Trump administration, it was killed in the early years of his administration. Before all you anti-Trumpers start sticking more needles in your Trump voodoo doll, it actually wasn't Trump who killed it. It was the courts through the lawsuits. It just happened to be passed under the Trump administration, where the courts pretty much said the DOL really was never granted the power to enforce laws on IRAs. Only 401ks. They don't have the right to mandate all of this involving IRAs. So it was kind of killed. Then the SEC, who many said should have been the regulatory agency trying to handle this anyways, started getting involved, and they came out with something called Reg BI, Regulation Best Interest. Again, won't bore you with all of that. SEC registered investment advisors and broker dealers have to abide by Reg Best Interest. In my opinion, it was a good intention, but handled like a bureaucracy handles things. It is, in my opinion, a total nightmare that nobody even pays attention to. Clients don't understand what the Reg BI is. They don't understand all these disclosure documents they're being given. Even the SEC concedes the documents, which can be no longer than 4 pages. Describing all of this that I'm talking about is confusing for people to read. It's written in legalese. It's in too small a font. No one is paying attention to it. It's a government bureaucracy, Chris, trying to solve a problem the way bureaucracy solve problems. And it's just not really working. But they have that Reg BI. Now the Department of Labor, very silently, folks, came out not too long ago, a couple of years ago, right at the last year of the Trump administration, by the way. So everyone who stuck the pins in the Trump voodoo dolls because of that, pull them out now. The very end of the Trump administration, the Department of Labor came out with another way, Chris, of kind of moving forward with this rule. And the industry has sued, but they didn't sue until recently. And the rule has come into place this year, folks. That's where I'm going with this. Came into effect in February of 2022. It was actually in effect in 2021, and they delayed it. Beginning in February of 2022, when you are moving a 401k to an IRA, the advisor is supposed to start disclosing more things to you, except for insurance-only advisors. I'll talk about that another day. So if you're moving a 401k to an insurance-only advisor who's most likely going to try moving you into a fixed indexed annuity or something like that, you're not going to see a lot of what I'm talking about. They're supposed to give you another form, 80, God, I wish I had it, 84-20 or 8840-20. I'll get the form, but that's a whole other thing. Where I'm going with this is, nowadays, a lot of what this gentleman is asking about is supposed to be reviewed with you. Now, they're enforcing it beginning in July. So you're going to see a lot of advisors by July starting to walk you listeners through this if you're moving a 401k into an IRA. If you're moving an IRA to an IRA, it's also supposed to be reviewed with you to make sure you're getting full disclosure of the cost of what this is going to be. It's going to be very hard as someone who is the quote-unquote chief compliance officer of my firm. It's a lot of work for us to try to do this, and I will have it up and running by July, obviously. It's because we have to try to determine the cost of a 401k, the true cost, and the clients, the people who are out there, Chris, often don't know what the 401k is really charging. And it's very hard to get. You have to get it out of regulatory filings, or you have to ask the 401k. So it's going to be very hard to discern what the true cost of the 401k is. It's also going to be hard to discern, Chris, those AUM advisors who are trying to roll everything into a 1.25%, 1.5% fee to truly separate out and say, hey, this is, yes, it's going to cost 1.5% to move your money to me, but look, in the 401k, maybe it's only costing you 0.5%. So it's going to be 1.5% with me, but I'm giving you this, that, and the other thing. The DOL doesn't care about that, Chris. They're just looking at the total cost. So someone like that, they're going to have a hard time trying to say, well, yeah, it's three times the cost if you move the money to me, but look, I'm going to do a retirement plan. I'm going to do this. I'm going to do that. You can specify that till the cows come home, but you still have to explain to your client, I'm charging you 1.5%. Perhaps a business model similar to what Chris and I do, where we separate that out, we always have. People don't have to move their money to us. Move your money to anywhere you want. If you move your money to us, we charge you just for asset management, as we are trying to explain on a series of EDU shows. And we also charge you for financial planning, totally separate, different contract, different everything. So when you start working with an advisor and moving money, listener, you're going to have to deal with this. You're also going to have to deal with this do-it-yourselfers if you're going to try to move a 401k or an IRA to Vanguard. They still have to go through all this with you. So expect a lot more paperwork, a lot more computerization, where they will start walking you through everything you listed here, the benefits of moving the 401k, you listed many: low fees, solid performance, legal protections, an investment that you can't get in the IRA, but you can in the 401k. There's just as many reasons to move a 401k to an IRA. Perhaps you have a wider investment choice. Perhaps you're trying to avoid mandatory required minimum distributions from a Roth 401k. Perhaps you're trying to consolidate everything. You don't want money in your 401k, your wife's 401k, a previous employer's 401k. You got accounts everywhere. Your life's a nightmare. You just want it simpler with one advisor or one custodian, you Vanguardians. I just want everything at Vanguard. It's my money. Why can't I move it? Well, the government is trying to protect you. You know, we're from the government. We're here to help. They're trying to protect you and say, wait a minute, before this money can move, you got to answer all these questions. There are very good reasons to leave money in a 401k, an equal amount of reasons to take money from a 401k. And it's not just fees. And at least the DOL has acknowledged that and said, just because the fees are different, they might be higher when they're moved, does not mean it's still not a reasonable or prudent reason. Just document what those reasons are. You may find you're going to have to start answering a lot more questions in the not too distant future on how to do all this. That's what I kind of wanted to share with our listeners, especially do it yourself as a wonder, well, geez, why the hell am I being asked to answer all these questions? This is why. Now, the industry is suing again, saying the DOL has no right to do this. I don't know if they're going to be right or they're going to be wrong, or what's going to happen. I just know you're going to start seeing a lot more of this, and definitely by July of this year. Yeah. Anything you want to add to that?
No, just there's always change. just got to stay up with it. And I think the intent is good. I think they missed the boat on a few things. You pointed out one of them where they put all this requirement on divulging what you'll be moving into, but they made it hard to assess what you were leaving. I think there should have been a rule that upon a simple request, a very clear description of the costs inside your 401k or other employer plan is given to you on a single page, clear, you know, this is what's going on, all the costs from everything related to that plan, so that you could compare it. Right now, you're right, it's very difficult to extract that information from the employer plan. And to my knowledge, there's nothing that makes them give a standardized, single page, easy to understand report upon demand.
No, I agree with you.
That should have been in there.
I agree, because it is, folks. So many people think, oh, I'm only paying this. You have no idea what you're paying in your 401k. It's more than what you probably think, less than what you're probably being told. And there's a lot involved in figuring it out. And Chris is right. They should have mandated that. What they did say, when it's being moved, if you can't get this information, and we're not going to be, if we're working with a client or if you're working with Vanguard, you Vanguardians, they're not going to contact them. We're not going to contact your 401k. First of all, the 401k will just hang up on us.
Right.
It's up to you. It's going to fall on your shoulders. And they would say, well, can you get us this? How much are you paying in the 401k? What is this? What is that? What is the average management fee? What are the accounts you're in? And what are their management fees? And you're going to throw up your hands and say, I don't know what the hell this is. And no one's answering. I didn't get time to do this. So the DOL lets us use the average cost for plans that size. Or they say to stop pulling the legal filings that 401ks have to do and figure it out yourself. Well, that's not going to happen. There are for financial planners listening to this, there are several companies stepping up for a subscription price, of course, that are going to start giving you all these average costs for plan sizes and fees, and they're pulling everything out. But it's giving us average, Chris, but it's not truly giving us what their 401k is.
Right.
It's just giving us average. I agree with you. They should have mandated 401ks also provide a very simple, easy one page. Here's the cost. Here's the revenue sharing. Here's the average cost of the funds, or here's all the funds in it and the cost of those funds. Yep. Here are those funds all averaged. Here is any management fee, because, you know, you can pay sometimes in a 401k to have companies, quote unquote, manage it for you. Here's what that cost is. It should all be laid out, but they don't do that.
Yep.
So that's what I'm saying, folks. This is kind of a nightmare on this. And it's new. I'm hoping calmer heads prevail as this goes on and they clean up this. The DOL's been trying for years to do it. It looks like they're going to get it done. I just don't think it was done well. Okay, before we wrap up the show, he had just a few more things that I do want to point out to him something. He said, my reasons for the Roth and to move my money to a Roth are to lower my required minimum distributions, lower the risk that the government's going to change taxes, or lower the risk that someday we're going to change tax status from our current joint to the one, what he's referring to there, folks, as a widow or a widower. So I want to, and I also want to lower future estate tax transfers to our children. Those are all wonderful reasons for moving the 401k to a Roth. It doesn't have to be all or nothing. If your 401k doesn't allow Roth option and in plan Roth conversions, maybe moving some money from the 401k to a Roth makes perfect sense. Maybe keeping that one really good fixed income holding you like, I'm guessing it's a stable value fund, Chris, because most investments in a 401k can be purchased inside an IRA as well. Proprietary investments from very large plans that are being managed specially for them, they call them separately managed accounts, those you may not be able to find. You don't have to move all of your 401k, folks, into an IRA. You can leave some in if you're getting good investment options in there that you can't get somewhere else. Of course, if you're looking to simplify, moving into an IRA is a better deal. You're going to have to weigh pros and cons. There's going to be no simple answer, Chris. This is what we're getting at. Chris and I say all the time, financial planning, which investment management is a part of financial planning, or according to the government, financial planning is a part of investment management. I like to say investment management is a part of financial planning. It's an art based on science. You can find a dozen reasons to leave it in a 401k and a dozen reasons to move it to an IRA. Just be prepared to better understand them and explain them, and don't be surprised if your advisory firm, whether it's do-it-yourself or Van Guardian or someone hiring a firm like ours to review this and better document what all these pros and cons are and why the reason to move was made. It's all because of this rule that's coming out. So I did want to point that out to him. It's not an all or nothing. But if you leave the money in a Roth converted 401k, do remember at 72, you're going to have Roth conversions, RMDs. So you're still going to, at that point, probably want to move it out, especially because he said, Chris, he wants his Roth for inheritance purposes. You're not going to start required minimum distributions from a Roth 401k if your aim is to leave it to your children tax-free. Right. So you're going to have to move that money eventually. So this is an ongoing, I don't want to say issue, but this is an ongoing evaluation all you retirees have to do. We tend to favor IRAs for simplicity. We just like clients to not have multiple accounts. I keep talking about my oldest client because I'm working with her a lot recently. She's 99. She has a hard time wrapping her mind, folks, around the two accounts she has. Could you imagine, Chris, if she had 5, 6, or 7? It just doesn't resonate as you get older. So we like simplicity, but we have often encourage clients to keep money in 401ks for the creditor protection if they needed it, especially if they were surgeons. You know, keep it in the 401k if you really want that creditor protection for the number of years you have to keep it there. So we can sometimes recommend that. And occasionally people do have an investment that they really like. It's no big deal to us the way we price our services on asset management. It doesn't matter to us where people have their money. But anyways, I just kind of wanted to share a little bit about that with our listeners, that they're going to notice some changes coming about.
Well, sounds good. Well, thanks for joining me again for another Q&A show. Those of you who want to send in questions to add to Jim's pile, do that by emailing him directly, jim@jimhelps.com, or you can go to the website and the contact form on there you can use. Website, of course, is jimhelps.com. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. Coming up next EDU show, we'll get to the fee structure for our asset management. Those of you who have been waiting to hear that. And I'm sure we'll have a whole slew of questions for next week's show.
Yeah, not just our fee structure. We're actually going to talk a lot about the industry's fee structure, which is a thorn in the side of Chris and I.
True.
And I'll walk people through how I came up with the fee structure that I have and why. But anyways, yeah, it's going to hopefully be an interesting show. To even do-it-yourselfers who don't pay a fee, just to learn a lot about how the industry prices things so you can help your friends who may be using someone who is charging a fee.
Perfect. Okay, well, you have a good weekend, and everyone else take care this week. We'll be back with you next week with a brand new show.
You have listened to Jim on the radio, read his quotes in the media, and enjoyed his banter on iTunes. But even now, you may wonder what sets Jim Salmier and Associates apart from other financial planning companies. The answer is quite simple. Jim's diverse team of professionals specializes in retirement planning. They form a lifelong relationship with you and measure their success not through product sales, but through the security and prosperity you may achieve in your retirement. Jim's entire team shares his unwavering commitment to placing their clients' best interests first while offering their services at fair prices with full disclosures. The professionals at Jim Salmier & Associates are available to assist you with your retirement planning needs. Visit jimhelps.com to schedule your complimentary coffee and a second opinion meeting. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. Or call 970-530-0556.
The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested in directly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Solnier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor.